Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And, you know, you're always in for a good surprise with me. Today will be no exception. My guest is Mike Lambert, and we just met. And as he said, I guess we're going to get to know each other as we go. Yes, dear, 100%.
Yes, we are.
You walked in and you said, I brought some things that will kind of lead to conversation. So, and then when I asked you before where you were from, and you said Chicago, and your mother moved you when you were two, and there's a longer story. Can you start with that one?
Well, yes, Janet. I was born in Chicago in the depth of the Depression. I'm born in 1934, and your listeners can do their own arithmetic there. When I was 18 months old...
I'm hoping they can do it in their heads. Go ahead.
When I was 18 months old, my father was killed in a truck train accident. And so that disrupted my mother's life and I guess mine too.
Were you an only child at that time?
Yes, I was. And we lived in an apartment there, I find out retroactively. So I grew up essentially in Iowa, where my mother had been from, with my mother and my grandmother.
Oh, was that part nice, your grandmother?
Was she what?
No, was that part nice, being with your grandmother?
Well, it was just the way life was.
Yes, I mean,
when you're 2, 3, 4, 6 years old, you don't have much perspective.
That's right.
You don't know that at the time, but now from my perspective, I realize that little kid didn't know very much. But I was conscious as a grade school student and a high school student that I didn't have a father.
And your mother never remarried.
She did. But that man turned out to be the husband of my mother.
I see, yes.
Rather than a more substantial role.
And so how did that set you apart or make you feel when...
Well, I noticed when going to houses of my schoolmate friends, they had mothers and fathers and sometimes sisters and brothers. And somehow that was interesting, but it didn't exactly match my life.
Did it make you sad?
No, because that's the way my life was.
Okay, good. All right.
But the thing that has brought this to the forefront of my mind is that on December 31st, just a few months ago, realizing my age, I sat down and wrote a letter to my father.
Oh, I'm going to cry. Okay, my best dreams come true. Go ahead. May I just see that, please, while you're... And that's the picture of him that you have.
And I ended up writing 5 or 6 letters to my father. I used as the inspiration for it a box of mementos, a box of memorabilia that my mother had kept.
Okay, so she kept things from him.
And so she had a box maybe 18 inches by 24 inches full of things. I had seen that box before, 2 or 3 times, but once when I was a teenager, and I probably had to go out and play with my friends or something, or go find my girl, so I didn't really pay attention to those things. But somehow, just at the end of December, I remembered that box, and I said, I wonder if what would be in there. And there are innumerable treasures. And that's what triggered the letters to my father.
Oh, these are fabulous. These are... Oh, okay. Well, maybe I could just ask you to read this one. Dear Father, it has been 80 years that we've been separated.
Yes, this is the first letter, dated December 31st, 2016. And it's dated... And I entitled it, Dear Father, A Conversation. Dear Father, it's been 80 years that we have been separated. Today, I will recognize your death. I have not acknowledged your death to you before this letter. And today is a good day to look backward at some aspects of my life. Perhaps the short 18 months that we were together. It will also be a good day to look forward to some aspects of my life yet to come. And that's how I started it. And I didn't know where I was going with that letter.
Okay. Is this too personal for you to read this last part?
Well, that's fine. My father was killed in a truck train accident in downstate Illinois. He was the owner of a truck firm. And my mother had kept the newspaper from the little small town called Lincoln, Illinois, the Lincoln Evening Courier. And that copy of the newspaper still existed, yellowed, in that box of memorabilia. So I pawed through that news article for this first letter. And I said, "You did not survive. And you left me as an 18-month-old baby. I suppose I was sleeping at the time of your crash. In a crib. In the apartment you provided for me. And for my mother in Chicago.
You had left me.
What? The evening before?
Did you kiss me goodbye?
Did I reply? Could I say, bye-bye, Dada, yet?"
There's so much to say about these. So you have this in a book form with pictures. And this is your father?
That was one of the memorabilia.
And this?
I'm guessing at the date, the age of this picture, and it looks like a young man, 17, 18, 19 years old, dressed in a suit and tie.
He looks like a handsome young man, and so does this.
And so I assumed that was my dad's graduation picture.
Sure.
In New York City. And I scrounged through my own memorabilia and found my high school picture. And there is quite a bit of similarity in their looks.
Yes. Well, I have a question about what will become of this. Do you have a family of your own? Do you have children?
I have three grown adult sons.
And, of course, they've seen this.
And two adult grandchildren and one more five-year-old granddaughter. So I sent this off about a month ago to my three sons and to the two adult grandchildren for their amazement or amusement, because I had never told them much about that part of my life, short though it was.
Mm-hmm. And what was their response?
Not very much.
Isn't that interesting?
I thought I was revealing a hidden story here, but with their busy lives, they haven't made much comment.
And that's like with your busy life, you didn't look through that treasure box until
Yes.
you were an older man.
Oh, good analogy. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Because somehow what we're in the middle of doing takes precedent for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going after school to get a milkshake and French fries is critical at a certain age, if you're
Yes.
lucky enough to live that kind of life.
Yes.
And, okay, so, but you saw things in his handwriting.
There were two or three handwritten things.
What did that evoke in you, his handwriting? If anything.
A comparison with mine.
I was going to ask you, is yours like his?
No, there wasn't that much handwriting to compare. What I did find in his wallet, there were four or five things stuffed in his wallet.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure they were truly the original things, but they were kind of startling. One thing was in his wallet was registration certificates, state registration certificates for four cars.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked my dad in the letter, "Where did you keep all those cars? Why'd you have that many?" Another thing that was in his wallet was three little pictures of two different women.
Uh-huh.
One picture I recognized clearly as my mother.
Beautiful, yeah.
The other two were of the same woman. They were slightly colored.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if they were State Fair or Carnival-type photo booths.
Oh, photo booths, absolutely.
From 1935, 36, or something like that. And I don't know who that woman is, so I ask him, "Who's that other woman that you kept in your wallet,
yes.
Dad?"
Oh, so many mysteries.
Tell me the story.
Gosh, sometimes there are ways of finding things out. So I have a question. There's no handwriting in this.
No.
And handwriting is so valuable, I think. Is there, I mean, this serves as a love letter. This is great. That answers my question, and that's it. But is there some way that you could make a little note or something in your own handwriting here and leave it somewhere before?
I suppose I could. Well, what I ended up doing was scanning those old photos that were in that memorabilia box.
Right.
I scanned the death certificate and put them into the book. I know how to do that.
Good.
I formatted the book with my word processor and then took it to FedEx office to be duplicated. And it was an emotional thing. I did it over a 5-week period of time, and I ended up writing the final letter. And I predated it. I was writing it about February 15th, and I dated it for March 6th because.
Did you do that on a word processor?
Yes,
okay,
right. Because that would be the 81st anniversary of his death. March 6th, 1936, in Lincoln, Illinois. And so I said at the end, I'm looking forward to meeting you soon.
Oh.
Where will we meet? Will it be in your truck terminal, maybe sitting around the pot-bellied stove? Or will we meet in the apartment where we lived together?
Now, you said that your children and your grown grandchildren didn't have much of a response yet.
Right.
Because this father and this loss is not part of their life.
That's true.
It is part of yours, a huge part of yours. But my experience has been that when they look at this and they're close to 80, it will mean something.
Probably
so. It will
so.
Be quite a legacy, Probably a couple so. Of things. And your great-grandchildren will find it. And, as I say, my experience is that people find something like this. If there's a trace of your own handwriting on it, it's really a pot of gold. And one of the best, what would you say the best thing is for a great-grandchild to find something like this in the attic?
The physical resemblance in the pictures. I've got about three pictures of me as a 15-month-old, 18-month-old baby. And then there's my father at age 30. He was 32, I think, when he died. And to my eyes, I see quite a resemblance. My wife sees that same resemblance.
So you could have great-grandchildren and be one of those gene-stomping families, and your great-grandchildren will
look
like you.
But that's the first time I've paid any attention, even looked for this resemblance, because it was a special mission I was on.
I think the other joy of finding something like this and the other legacy for them is you, that they had a grandfather or great-grandfather who was able to do this. These beautiful things. It's a legacy of love.
It has a lot of meaning to me, and I hope it'll have some or a lot of meaning for my sons and grandchildren and however many others come along.
Okay, so I have a suggestion, and I try not to be the love letter police, but I just have an addition to this that I personally think would be great. What if you wrote a little something on this back page?
In hand.
Yes, in your handwriting.
I think that would be a nice addition.
Wouldn't it? And just to say, you know, what you just said.
To the kids to come.
To the kids to come. I hope that you find something. Whatever it is you want to say, you're a good writer. You'll figure it out. And my experience is that things found later, 40 years later, 80 years later, 100 years later, it is a look into the past that we don't usually get.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a love letter to every one of your descendants.
At this stage, now that I've done this, I have more questions about my grandfather on the other side of my family, and I know practically nothing about him.
And so you're at a stage of life, and people have gone where you can have only questions and not get answers?
Well, I suppose there's lots of things I've observed in life, and things are not quite as clean-cut as I thought when I was age 18 or 36.
What is? Excuse me. I'll take care of this later. So my next question is, could you see yourself doing another series of letters? Letters that ask questions?
Well, I'm not so sure. My mother lived until she was age 66.
Well, that's not so long either.
And what I peeked into was this little private life between her and my father for 3 years in Chicago, Illinois. I wish she were here to see this.
Yes.
That I was asking of her husband, my father. And some questions I would ask, some new ones I would ask if she were here. So it's possible.
Do you have cousins anywhere that you know of?
No, I have a 9-year-old younger sister back in Iowa.
Uh-huh.
A 17-year younger brother back in Iowa.
But they didn't know your father.
No,
right.
No, and they were from mother's husband.
Right. Was he was he a nice person?
Well, he was a unique personality. He had come over from Russia as a child and was part of a small Jewish community in our little town of Oskaloosa, Iowa. And whereas I had been raised Catholic by my grandmother, so we had that difference between
cultural
us.
Cultural gap.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
But was your mother Jewish?
No, she was raised Catholic too, mm-hmm. And she met this Jewish man, and I think was pressured. This would have been 1941, 42, 43.
Two.
Pressured to find somebody to help support her and her...
I see. Yeah, sure. Right.
Son, she was what they called a single mother.
Yes.
But they didn't have those phrases then.
That's right. Now, what is it you're writing now? I see you have two books there, and I know you've written some mysteries. Is this right?
I got caught up with creative writing at age 75.
Good for you.
I had been an engineering undergraduate as a young man in college. Had been a general manager for the telephone company, had written a lot of business communications. But when I retired and my wife and I moved to a senior community in the foothills up in California. And I had done some teaching before, so I started a lifelong learning program.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was a writer's workshop.
And where do you do that?
We did it in the community center in that
and
town.
What, I see.
The community was Penn Valley, California, about 12 miles west of Grass Valley.
Just at
the beginning of the foothills. So,
yeah, sure.
So I started doing publicity for the lifelong learning program, and that led to a couple newspaper columns, and that led to a couple stories and a writer's workshop. And I've kind of hooked since
then. So what are you brought two books. Why don't you tell three books? Do you want to tell us the titles? Because people might want to go.
Sure.
Although if they Google Mike Lambert.
I don't think they'll find much.
I don't think it wasn't easy.
No.
What should they look
for?
I don't do
Facebook. I don't do LinkedIn.
That doesn't mean you're not on Google once you've sold a book. But they can go to Amazon.
Well, it came time once we'd had 3 or 4 or 5 writers' workshops, I realized that these senior citizens have got some good stories to tell.
Okay.
And somehow I stumbled across a couple of online literary reviews.
Mm-hmm.
The first one I saw was Minnetonka Review, Minnetonka, Minnesota. And I don't know what they have there, except they used to do, there used to be toys for children.
Oh, called Tonka Toys.
Tonka Toys,
sure,
yeah.
Sure.
They had an online literary review. So the next meeting of the writer's workshop, I said, we could do this. And I wrote a tongue-in-cheek, 2-paragraph story, because, and I called it a clean, well-lighted spa. I had recently read the whole big volume of Hemingway's stories. I was struck, of course, with his classic called A Clean, Well-Lighted mm-hmm. Place. And so I ripped off two different paragraphs of a story called A Clean, Well-Lighted Spa, with the author being Ernestine Hemming. Ernestine Hemming. And she talked about how she and Joe had just closed the Iron Horse Bar. That simple little two paragraphs led to a short story. That led to the first chapter of my book, which is called I, Jessica, Finding My Way.
So you're writing in the person of Jessica?
Can you imagine that? I am.
Well, I can.
Here I am, a 75-year-old gray-haired guy, and I'm trying to write a first-person female voice story of Jessica Jones, a young woman living in contemporary San Francisco, who grew up in Peoria, Illinois, just like I had grown up.
So the Illinois part I can understand that you can understand. How do you get into the soul of a young woman?
Well, I did it. And I've asked quite a few female readers afterwards, did I capture her? Does she sound like a realistic woman? And they universally say yes. I was inspired to write this story by several dinner table, cocktail table stories from my wife and her longtime friends. Three or four of them had come out to San Francisco in the 1960s. No job, no place to live, and found their way.
Well, in 1960, you could come here and find an apartment, for starters.
Yes, and afford it.
Yes.
But they had to find jobs. And I was my wife's age at the time, married to another woman, but I wouldn't have done that in my life, go to a town I didn't know with no job. And so I was always struck by the courage that those young women had.
And so Jessica has
Has several of those attributes and several of those incidents.
So you can't imagine the courage.
Well, I did, and I don't know if it's how much literary merit there is in this book, but I did it.
Good for you.
So that was my first book, I, Jessica, Finding My Way. I call it a coming-of-age story for a 30-year-old working girl in San Francisco. That led a couple of years later to my second novel called I, Jessica, Iron Horse Mysteries. And Jessica works at a restaurant called the Iron Horse Bar and Restaurant, which was a real restaurant in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
It's wonderful.
19 Maiden Lane.
Yes.
And you, my dear, are probably old enough to remember that place.
I'm the same age you are.
So you do remember that place?
Yes.
I would
remember it well. I mean, I had many, many lunches there.
It was apparently a hot spot for a lot of the politicians and the movers and shakers of San Francisco. It closed up in 1973, but I have tried to reconstruct it.
Good for you.
Because I remember going there a few times when I was working downtown, and we would have visitors from out of town, and I would take them there for lunch and occasionally dinner.
And those were the days of the three martini lunch.
Yes, yes,
and
they were.
That's always bewildered me. I mean, you would see businessmen having many martinis for lunch. I, of course, don't know how they could even stand up at the end of it. Or live to tell the tale. And I'm guessing that then we called it a three martini lunch. Today we would recognize it as an alcoholic problem, right? Or not necessarily.
Well, I would hope so. There was also a restaurant and bar in downtown San Francisco called Breen's, right off of 3rd Street, where the Chronicle or Examiner newspaper building was. I forget which newspaper. That was frequented by business people as well as the newspaper crowd, the columnists.
Yes. Oh, that's wonderful that you've done that. What's that little slim volume sitting over there?
Well, this summer I was I was sitting there without much to do in my home office, and I put together a collection of 10 or 15 short stories that I had written over the last 5 years. I call it Voices, Stories by Mike Lambert. Mm-hmm. And I have I found myself using several pseudonyms when I was writing short stories.
Oh, I see that. Anthony Colombo.
And Nick Vitelli.
Nick Vitelli.
A freelance reporter. And so I put some of Nick's stories in there, and several of the characters from my Jessica novels, and then I made up a couple new ones.
This is great. I hope you leave a trail of things with your handwriting in it, like a little something, some little note in there that you signed. Handwriting is king, really. When you look at handwriting of old, and by the way, that yellow newspaper article, is there some way of refreshing that? Can we do that with old yellowed newspaper articles?
I'm not sure.
Is it too late to put it in some kind of acid-free folder? Or
I don't know. I should probably look. I'm amazed that here it is 81 years later, and although it's not had much use, it's been buried in a box or a suitcase for years and years. It does show yellowing. But it's still there.
A friend of mine once told me something very valuable, and she was talking. She's older than I am, and she was talking about some facial routine she had at some point. And I don't know. I said something, and she said, "You know," she said, "it's never too late to preserve what's left." And she said it cosmetically, but I think that's true.
I was struck by that newspaper article. It was so much detail. And the reporter the train wreck happened at 3:30 in the morning. It was a Friday morning, and that newspaper reporter probably had to go to finish his story by 9 or 10 in the morning. And he gave so much detail to it. He'd interviewed the local cops, the local coroner, the two train crewmen.
That kind of indicates a respect for a life, doesn't it?
Well, it was well done, and the poor person, and it's probably a guy in 1936, he didn't get to put a byline on his article.
Oh.
And I was so sorry for him because I'd been writing the last 2 or 3 years and was thinking that that everybody ought to get recognized writing.
Okay, so that's why you want to leave a nice, clear trail of little handwritten things on the flyleaf there. I have a question. Did your mother miss him forever? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know.
Did she talk about him?
No, she was quite private about that part of her life. She reluctantly showed me that box of treasures 2 or 3 times in her life.
So that was a different time where people were more like that.
Yes.
And it kind of robs you twice.
Yes, because she didn't sit around the breakfast table and tell me about Dad.
Right. And how wonderful that you have so many of his great qualities. Yes, that's valuable. You probably do.
Well,
I want to thank you for doing this.
It's hard to know.
It is hard to know, but you've done something wonderful here. Those letters are gorgeous. It would be nice if somehow they could be out in the public. Well, we'll see. Okay. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm so glad we met.
Thank you, Janet. It's nice to talk with you this morning.
Thank you, dear. So until next time, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.